Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with the beautiful, the talented, the extraordinary actor, singer, diva, Rebecca Kane, who is currently starring in Living on Love at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. Living on Love is about an opera diva, and it is played gloriously by Rebecca Kane and her outrageous husband, the maestro. Listen to Rebecca's interesting, unexpected story, and also hear her glorious voice. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are, not the person you think you're supposed to be, not the person other people are, not the person someone else told you you had to be, but the person that you really are. And the person whose interview I am airing today is very definitely who she really is. The glorious voice that began this show belongs to Rebecca Kane, clearly an opera singer and a very talented actress. But more than that, Rebecca is who she really is. In this interview, you don't hear guile, you don't hear second guessing, you don't hear pretense. You hear the very real, the very vulnerable, the very open Rebecca Kane. You have an opportunity to not only listen to Rebecca in this interview, but to see her glorious talent, her joyful performance in Living on Love. If you like to laugh, if you like to be taken away from your life for a couple of hours, if you like to enjoy yourself, give yourself a treat. Come out and see Rebecca in Living on Love. And this was a long interview, which I really did not want to cut. So rather than talk any longer, I want to introduce the real Rebecca Kane. I'm here with Rebecca Kane, and Rebecca is here starring in Living on Love, which is the second non-musical production at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. And I'm explaining to Rebecca that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, the art to which you are giving your life is the art of acting. Would I be correct?
Yes, I guess so. I've always sung. This is my first straight play.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so, okay, so singing and acting.
Yes, I started as a musical theatre singer and became an opera singer. And now I'm whatever anybody wants me to be, really.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
So, I only ask one question. Can you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when you thought singing, performing, entertaining, getting attention, music, any of that called you, occurred to you, compelled you?
Yes, yes. Very, very clearly. My parents were amazing about taking us to art, to the opera and to galleries and things like that. And when I made up my mind, I was five, and we saw a touring production of Carmen, and I demanded a pair of castanets and said, that's what I'm going to do.
So clearly you remember this
very,
very, very clearly,
yes,
right?
Do.
Do you remember your parents' reaction?
No, I don't.
Did they get you castanets?
Yes, they got me castanets. Absolutely. I used to listen to the Metropolitan Opera broadcast every Saturday afternoon, and I used to pull a chair up so I could climb up to the record player and drop the needle on it. So I was always listening to something, and we didn't have television, so I was very focused on classical music. Was my big thing. I loved it, absolutely loved it. And then they took me to see Turandot at the Met with Birgit Nilsson and Franco Corelli, and I had already listened to it very extensively, and I can remember that really clearly, and I was six. And so from that day forth, apart from a brief flirtation with becoming an astronaut in the late 60s when they made the moon landings, but I didn't have the maths and science, so I thought, no, that I never wavered. I was just always going to be a singer.
Wow.
I was always going to be on stage.
So did you have lessons? I mean, did they...
I did, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to be careful about starting singing lessons when you're a child, particularly classical. But I think I started when I was 13. I went to the Westminster Choir School, and I had, I think, half-hour lessons with a student. And then I moved up to somebody who was a bit, you know, more of a... As my voice matured, and I hit 16 and things like that.
So from five or six, you were just singing for yourself.
Oh, I used to wait till everybody was out of the house, and then I'd put Act Two of Tosca on, and I'd get a carving knife in the kitchen, and I'd stagger around the living room, pretend to stab Scarpia, and I'd get the candles, and I'd put it on either side of the invisible Scarpia's body, and I'd say, Avanti a lui tremava tutta Roma, and I'd reenact the whole thing, so yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, so it was clearly... You knew it the minute you saw it, right?
I did. But I have to say all kudos to my parents, because I did recently take all the Super 8 film off my mama and have it digitized. And really, I can see no stage presence at all in these early things.
So were you in drama class?
I only did 2 years of high school. First year we did Kiss Me Kate, and I danced in the chorus. And then the second year we did Music Man. And
okay, so you said you only went to 2 years of high school?
Yes.
Then what happened?
Well, I was not very good at school, right from the word go, and I hated it, which is hilarious because I come from academics on both sides of my family. My parents split up. My mother decided to take myself and my younger sister to England, and then I didn't go back to school, so I didn't do my junior and senior years at school. And then she returned to my dad and took my little sister back with her, and I went to the Guildhall School of Music Conservatoire very early at 17 and sort of started there. So I've never finished any form of education. I was subsequently thrown out of the Guildhall as well.
Why?
I went too young. And I'm not a very academic person. It's funny, I'm coming to studying much later in life, and piano lessons and all this sort of stuff. And I fell between the cracks because I was rather undefinable, and I still am in some ways, because I think people like to be able to pigeonhole you and say, you do this and you do this. And if somebody does a wide variety of things, well, there's that expression, jack of all trades, master of none.
Yes.
I think they didn't really know what to do with me. I staggered on, but in a way, being a kid that I'm originally Canadian, but I grew up in the States, and I'd had the dance background, and I had done the musicals and things like that when I left the Guildhall. And it was I like to say they threw me out, but it was more of a mutual parting of the ways. I was instantly really employable, because in those days in Britain, there weren't many people who were sort of triple threats. I'm not a fantastic dancer, but, I was a decent natural actress, and I could sing, and I just had that kind of let's put on a show thing that you grow up with in this country. So so I joined a little opera company for 9 months, and I got my full equity card, and within 9 months of leaving the Guildhall, I was playing Laurie in Oklahoma in the West End, Cameron McIntosh.
Oh my
which
God.
Was quite a shock.
Yes.
Quite a shock to find myself suddenly starring a role in the West End. And I have to say, in all honesty, I don't think it was because I was that fantastic. I don't think there was a great deal of competition, and I don't think that would have happened now. I have been very lucky, I think.
Well, yes. I don't think there's any doubt about it. Am I getting the sense that you were a little bit of a rebel, or not? I'm not getting that.
I'm not great with authority.
Yes, that was what I was feeling. Right?
And I've learned over the years.
The hard way.
The hard way. Okay. And I think too. It took a few years to get the sharp edges rubbed off me, and I think there was also something about me. I remember when I joined English National Opera, and the director said to me later on, he said, "Oh, you walked in the room," and I thought, "Here's trouble." And I thought, but I was just wondering and thinking, wow, I'm in English National Opera. There's just something about me that you know, it's shyness. Some of the times, and when I teach myself, I have to think about this. My own students, when they come across as arrogant, and actually they're just kind of desperately trying to keep afloat and not to make idiots of themselves, and they're young and gauche. And I was always being thrown into situations that I wasn't really prepared for. In any way, I mean, I wasn't prepared to go into the business at 19. I barely knew how to boil an egg or take care of myself or anything.
No, I think that's very clear.
It was all a bit too soon.
No, and also this thing of not completing the formal education. One of the things that formal education does for you is socializes you, because you have to get along with whoever is there,
yes,
right?
Very
you
know? Good point.
Right?
Yes. Oh, well, yes. No, well, I desperately failed on the
well,
social
Well, it isn't
front.
So much that you didn't
that
so you failed,
gauche.
That you didn't get it.
I didn't have the equipment.
You didn't have it.
No,
I mean, if you had been allowed to stay in school, some of that stuff is what's happening in school, and you didn't have that.
It's true, and I was also very strangely raised in America by a British mother who, she raised us as exiles to a country we didn't know. So I had a lot of, we didn't have TV, and I had a lot, I read all the British kids' novels.
Yeah, right.
I had an accent, which I shouldn't have had. I was born in Canada and I grew up here. I had this accent, so I never really fitted in, and that kind of became where I felt comfortable was not quite fitting in, and that's rather gone on, and this strange career I've had when I've just jumped from different genres. So, and my parents, my mother was had a terrible war, she was deeply traumatized what happened to her, she was nearly killed by the Germans, separated from her father. I mean, many people had terrible wars, but, my mother is still living her war to this day. My father was an only child, so,
Yes, no, you didn't have
family.
No.
I wasn't really given the equipment to get along with people.
No, you really didn't.
No.
You had all of your experiences encourage you to be kind of solo.
Yeah.
And even the thing of, people go out and I start to sing, I start to perform. You didn't do it while they were there. You did it when they left.
Yeah,
so
that's
it's
true.
All that stuff. And I suspect that some of that is communicated by you even though you aren't aware that you're sending it.
Oh, I'm sure you're absolutely right.
You know,
yeah.
Right, which is probably part of what he felt, right, when he said, you know, here comes trouble.
Yeah.
You don't blend, you know, you don't merge.
Well, I was always, the little chorus work I did, I was always promoted almost instantly.
Yeah, right. Well, you stand out. You stand out. And this is a mixed bag, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Right? On the one hand, it is, I'm pretty sure, responsible for your early success. You stand out.
Yeah, it was different.
I guess there's something unique.
That and the fact there wasn't a huge amount of competition. I really got to say that.
Well, even if there was, and even if there wasn't, there were certainly other choices beside you.
Oh, yeah, there always are.
That's
always
right.
Somebody else they can employ.
That's exactly so right. So, and it's interesting because I think exactly the reason that you didn't fit in the Guildhall for some of the reason that you had some of the success that you had.
Yeah,
it's an ironic.
I've never thought of that before.
But you know what I mean?
All the years of therapy. I've never come out, I want my money back.
Okay, so, and again, it's so interesting because clearly what you said at the beginning was about, you know, wanting to be on stage, wanting to perform, to be a performer, right?
Mm.
And yet the early performances are all solo in your house with the, you know, I love the thing with the candles.
But it wasn't, going to what you said earlier, I think something that civilians, as we call them, people who aren't in the business, think about people who go on stage, they think we're there for that moment when the applause is happening, which is actually what most turns, as we call ourselves, find curtain calls rather uncomfortable.
I'm sure.
You know, we've done our show and now we have to stand there. And while you know, we can tell from the level of applause whether you liked us or not, that's very uncomfortable. I have this with my own family and some of my friends. They think you do what you do for attention. And it was never about that. It was about the music, so much about the music. And it was about wanting to be in those situations playing those people. And I certainly know that when I've done some operas I've done, some things I've done, they've been quite obscure and we haven't had a big audience, and I haven't actually cared how many people were in the audience because I just wanted to go out and be in that, on that stage doing that thing. It didn't matter to me whether there were people out there watching it.
So again, it's a conundrum, I think. Early on, you you don't do anything that anybody else does, and then you get this role so young, and you said your mother went back to your father. Did you stay in England? Is that?
Yes, well, that's why I was rather left behind
at
17. Yeah, and that's, I went to the Guildhall, and I think that was probably another reason. I mean, I think they really thought that they were doing the right thing, and in some ways they were. I don't know what would have happened to me if I'd come back here, and
Wait a minute, who, you think your parents thought they were doing the right thing by
leaving me there and not bringing me back and putting me back into high school and making me finish my education and kind of coming back to America and staying here.
But do you remember what you wanted?
Well, I didn't want to go back to high school, that's
for
sure.
Oh, God. Well, not at that age, anyway.
No, I wanted to go to the Guildhall, and then the Guildhall didn't, you know, I just didn't.
God, this must have been such a difficult time for you.
Yeah, it was, and looking back on it, and
I mean,
I kept going, really, because, I mean, I was getting the message most of the time that I wasn't good enough, and that I didn't have what it took, and I just kept going.
Yeah, do you know where you got that? Because, really, you had surprisingly little support.
Yeah, and those were the days where, I mean, one of the things about touring now, being away from home, is I can sit and FaceTime with my husband, and it's like sitting in the room with him. Well, we wrote letters, airmail letters, and we only phoned if there was an emergency. My parents used to call it the transatlantic sob, because they'd pick up the phone, and they'd hear that click, and they'd hear the transatlantic line, and then they'd hear this. Not like I was floating in a raft in the Mediterranean, and I don't want to be over dramatic about it. But no, it wasn't easy, and actually, I didn't deal with it very well. I suffered from a great deal of depression.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't.
And it was partly also because Oklahoma came off and I went into the national tour of My Fair Lady playing Eliza.
Oh, wait a minute. Give me some chronology here.
So this is, I'm 9 months out of Guildhall. I go into Oklahoma in the West End. I do that for a few months and then the notice goes up on the show. So Cameron McIntosh put me into the national tour of My Fair Lady with me playing Eliza. This is my third job. And Eliza is, it's all of the short play with 12 numbers, and when you're off stage, you're changing costume.
Oh, yeah, you're
there's
on stage
also a huge yeah. expectation in that role, because everybody thinks they know how it should be played.
Yeah.
I was playing opposite a Higgins, who, he's still alive, only just, who was 57, and I was 21, and he spent most of the tour trying to get me into bed.
Yeah.
And then when I wouldn't sleep with him, he spent the rest of the tour trying to get Cameron McIntosh to fire me. And he used to do things like in the lesson scenes when he'd just put marbles in her mouth and chocolates, he would put too many in, and I'd be worried I was going to swallow one. It was very, very, very unpleasant. This was the very early 80s, and you know, there was a certain amount of sexism and misogyny that you accepted. I mean, I certainly remember coming home from all sorts of rehearsals and feeling dirty, like I'd been touched all over, which I had been, and feeling very upset about it, but simply not having the frame of reference to know why it was making me feel so depressed, and I didn't have the comeback for it.
No, you know, no.
And I certainly didn't have the power.
No.
And if I did, and I said no, and I stood up for myself, that was even worse, because that you instantly were nailed as being difficult.
Yes.
And that's something I think I've had trouble with all my life, because I'm not unintelligent. My father was a professor in the maths department at Princeton. My grandfather was the vice chancellor of Cambridge University. I come from smart people. Chances are I've inherited some of their brains. I am also quite articulate. And when you play ingenues on stage, when you play victims particularly, people are appalled if they go into your dressing room and you can argue your case. And I've had to learn. It's wonderful to see things changing now, but I had to learn that I had to bite my tongue and put up with an awful lot of stuff. And that was very depressing. But I think the other thing is that, you know, I did have this wonderful early success, but I certainly, after My Fair Lady, I mean, I had what was pretty close to a nervous breakdown, because I couldn't understand why I was playing this fantastic role in this wonderful big production, and I was so unhappy.
Yes.
And I didn't understand what was going on. And it took, after that, I took a chorus job in a smallish opera company, and that was weird too, because it didn't really fit in there either, because I'd only been a principal up to there. That sounds so tragic. It was not really, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
Actually, I think it was pretty tragic. No, I do.
Well.
I do. I think what you're saying is that, and forgive me, you can tell me I'm all wrong, and you can tell me not to talk, but what it sounds like is that you didn't have very much in the way of support or a backstop or education that would have prepared you for the kinds of things that you were going to run into.
No, that's true.
But you were so talented that you got stuff that you were not prepared to deal with. You could do the job, you could sing the songs, you could do the acting, but you weren't prepared to deal with...
I didn't have any of the tools.
No. And there was nobody there. There was nobody.
There was no one there. And I used to think, because I remember when I was in the small opera company, and after a couple of seasons I was promoted, and no one would talk to me. The principals wouldn't talk to me, and the chorus wouldn't talk to me. And we were touring in Bath, and I got terrible flu. And I remember being violently sick. I was playing the littlest three little maid in a pity sing in the Mikado, and Yum Yum and the other mezzo, I can't remember her name now, I just did it last year, but we're chatting away, and I had my head in the sink turning inside out, and then I went to the hotel and I lay in my bed for 3 days and no one came to check to see if I was okay. But you know, I must have, you know, like, I can't say it was just them and it was all me. I just didn't handle things very well, and why would I? Because I obviously didn't have the thing. But I used to look at these girls and whoever was bullying me, and I used to think, you know what, you can go home to your mum
at the
weekend.
That's exactly right.
And you
right.
can pick up the phone and you can talk to your parents. I don't have anybody in
That's
this
right.
country.
That's
I
right.
have no, I don't have school people I went to school with.
That's
I
right.
had nothing. I had one rather roguish boyfriend from the Guild Hall who kept saying things to me like, my career comes first. He was an absolutely terrible actor, I'm going to tell you. And I knew he was a terrible actor on some level, because he used to kind of practice it all in the
the mirror?
In the mirror, pretty much. Bless his heart. He's a very successful writer now, I'm happy to say. But he, no, it was not, it was, I didn't, but he wasn't supportive either, because I didn't know how to seek out the supportive people.
No, that's
I was attracted to the people who gave me a hard time.
That's right.
You know, so.
Well, you know that we get what we're expecting.
Exactly.
Right?
We look for it,
and it feels like home, you know?
It's true. Right? I think of all the nice men that came to me later and said, God, I really, really wanted to ask you out. And I'd say, why not? They said, oh, you were so out of my league. I said, but you were so nice. God, what a different life I would have had. But I did meet a very nice man eventually, actually, my company manager on My Fair Lady, but I didn't go out with him for a few years because he seemed like too much of a nice thing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, what's really interesting about you for me is that given what you didn't get, really, that you, as you said just a little while ago, you just kept going. You just kept putting one foot in front of the other.
I didn't really have a choice.
Of course, I didn't have
anywhere to go back to or anything else that I could do. I had no educational qualifications.
Oh, yeah.
I just had to kind of keep going.
Well, so you did. So, okay, so we have Cameron McIntosh era,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Then we have the small opera company.
That's a small opera company to get my card and then the two shows for Cameron. At the end of Fair Lady, as I said, I just couldn't cope, and I started I went into the opera company, and then I became a principal, and then I was supposed to go to Glyndebourne Opera to be an apprentice there, and I got West Side Story, which kills me, because I came to see here the fantastic West Side Story the other day, and it breaks my heart, because I got Maria in the West End, and my then agent, because I was booked to go to Glyndebourne, they wouldn't take a six-month contract, West Side Story. And so without coming back to me and saying, would you like to go to Glyndebourne Opera or would you like to do West Side Story? He told West Side Story that I couldn't do it and I had to go to Glyndebourne. So that Christmas, I spent selling knickers in Selfridges, getting up every morning and thinking I could be playing my dream role. West Side Story was the musical that made me go, oh, my God, I'm not sure I don't want to be in musical theatre. It's this weird place I've lived my whole life, my whole career. Am I an opera singer? Am I an actress? What am I? And West Side Story did that to me. So I spent 6 months and it was very miserable and I didn't work. And I went to Glyndebourne to be in the chorus, which was a wonderful experience. And I just got together with my then boyfriend, now husband, at that period. And the understudy system there is brilliant. They prepare you to the point you want the person you're understudying to have a small non-maiming accident or miss the train so you can go on, and they keep an eye on you. And
so you finally got some training.
I learned everything on the job. Learned on the job and on the hop, and I faked it basically. But it was while I was there, and we were doing a production of Idomeneo. It was a revival of a production they'd done the year before, and it was Mozart's Idomeneo, and because I was a bit of a nifty mover, I had to be a high priestess doing a little bit of dancing. And a very famous director who had put this production on came down to work with the chorus in doing improvisation, and I noticed he was watching me all the time. Even when I was in the restaurant, I could just feel his eyes on me, just watching me. And at the end of one of the chorus rehearsals on stage, we broke for lunch, and it was like those Busby Berkeley movies. The chorus went one way, and the director's arm went round my shoulder, and he walked me into the wings. And he said, I want you to be in this new musical that I'm doing. And I said, oh, I can't. I'm going to be an opera singer, and I've been told I can't do any more musicals and nobody will take me seriously. Da, 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 da. Well, this man paid me no heed. And I was washed and brought to his tent at the Royal Shakespeare Company, because the person that I was talking to was Sir Trevor Nunn, the director of Cats.
Yes.
And we were going to do this musical based on this colossus of French literature with a rather sad name that I didn't have time to read, because I was whisked straight into rehearsals at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And it was Les Miserables. But of course we didn't know it was going to be Les Miserables, because who would know in any way, nothing like Les Miserables had ever happened before, that it was going to turn into what it was going to turn into. And even talking to you, I start to feel shivery and shaky and a bit weepy about the whole thing because, to have been a part of something that is means so much to people and has gone on to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But back then, we had this long rehearsal period of 6 weeks, I think, we had, and playing improvisations, and it was very, very long. It was about 40 minutes longer than the show is now. And we were just wandering around in the dark and putting on one different set of grey rags and another different set of grey rags. I had the only nice frock in the show because I was Cosette. And so the roles became what me made of them. So all those high notes, the little floated high notes and everything, I put them in. So that's my DNA runs in the bones of that show, which wow. is an amazing thing to feel, you know. And I remember I had my boyfriend, now husband, come along to the first preview, and people were very negative about it. I don't know why. Well, I do know why. I think that people felt that Cameron McIntosh was taking advantage of the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is run on public money, to line his own coffers. But Les Mis has put £1 million into Les Mis's, into the Royal Shakespeare Company's coffers for 30 years now, so they've done very well out of it. And there was just kind of this anti-feeling against it. But my husband came along to the first preview, and I said, because I wasn't experienced enough to know, later on when I've been in good shows, I thought, this is good. And I said to him, what do you think? He said, it's going to be huge. It's going to be massive. And we opened, and we had mixed reviews. We weren't totally slammed. We had some raves, and we had some absolute horrible turkey, really aggressive. And some newspapers kept coming back at us week after week saying, this is rubbish, and why are they doing this? It was West Side Story, the year it opened, The Music Man, also a wonderful show, but not a game changer,
right.
won the Tony on Broadway.
Right, right.
You know, sometimes these things aren't recognized at the time.
When almost they open, always.
Almost always.
Because when the game changers always trigger resistance.
Exactly. But I remember at the Barbican, before we transferred to the West End, because the audience was quite steep, the scrim, the gauze coming down at the end of Act 1, because it's the wonderful Act 1 finale. And I saw this man just jump to his feet and throw his arms up in the air, and he shouted to no one. He just shouted, this is the greatest musical I've ever seen in my life, like this. And we transferred to the West End. Not that Cameron McIntosh wanted to bring it in, I would add here. He won't like people knowing that, but he didn't want to. And Trevor and John, the directors, persuaded him to. And the queue started at the box office, and they went all the way around the theatre and double back, and I was too young to really, really, really appreciate it. And when I finished that job, I went into Phantom, which had been running for 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and I went into that as alternate. And so basically I cornered the market in slightly boring French virgins in the mid-80s with my little niche. But that wasn't a very happy show. Phantom wasn't a very happy show. Les Mis was wonderful because it was very democratic. There were no stars. It was that really British situation of everybody working, nobody being better than everybody else. And I think it's very, very healthy.
Yeah, ensemble.
Phantom was ensemble. Phantom was completely different. There was a real hierarchy. It was not a happy show. It was not a nice show. And I was the first person to come in from the outside.
Oy.
And the knives went into my back before I even walked in. And I managed 9 months on that. And we came to a mutual parting of the ways. And then Andrew Lloyd Webber asked me if I would like to go and alternate on Broadway and then take over there. And I thought, that doesn't sound like a good situation either. And then I got off at the Canadian production, which was a fresh production, a new production. And so I went and did that with Colm Wilkinson, who played my dad in Les Mis. He was playing the Phantom. And we got to record that. So I got to ride the horse that threw me, because
mm-hmm.
Phantom was very traumatic for me, very unpleasant. And whilst I was in Phantom, the man who had been running Glyndebourne when I'd been in Glyndebourne had had me back while I was in Les Mis to make my solo debut. So I'd actually been singing at Glyndebourne and in Les Mis for the second summer Les Mis was on, which was exhausting but amazing. And the man who had run Glyndebourne was now running the Canadian Opera Company, and I kind of hoped that they might offer me a small role. So I got a letter from him one day, and it said, would you be interested in singing the title role in Alban Berg's Lulu? So I had to sit down very hurriedly, because it's like asking an actor who's just done a couple of musicals to play Hamlet. It's the only way I can, or King Lear, it's the only way I can describe it. Lulu is the most extraordinary, difficult role musically, dramatically, but luckily I'd always had this enormous love of 20th century music. I've got a good ear for it, and it frankly kept me sane. I spent a whole year trotting down to the Canadian Opera Company whilst I was singing Andrew Lloyd Webber every night and learning this very difficult score. And then I took 3 months out of Phantom, went to the Canadian Opera. No one thought I could do it. When they announced it at the press conference, I remember I was sitting next to one of the critics. He said, I suppose you'd like to work here one day. And I said, well, maybe I will. And I remember he turned over when they gave them the announcement. He went, like this. And so no one thought I'd be able to do it. But the fact of the matter was that I am a legitimate soprano and I sing. I don't need a mic to sing. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm mic'd in a musical I need one. And I worked very, 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 very hard, and I had a huge success with it. So that's after that. I didn't have a great time on that Phantom either. I don't think it's a very happy show. I think it's another case of you play the victim and you stand up for yourself off stage, you get given a hard time. So that was it for me in musicals. And I quit them, and for 17 years I just sang opera.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and here you are now in your very first non-musical, non-opera role.
Well, yes, and so at 40, which is quite some time ago now, because I'm a light lyric, the roles I played were all, they were all 18-year-old girls, you know, and I remember being 46 and being in, having to go to New Zealand, so I was already suffering from jet lag, and I arrived there and it was Elixir of Love, and the director said, I've set this in Napa Valley High School in 1985 and you're the prom queen. And I thought, great, I'm going back to 1985. I was older than 18 in 1985, actually. I was 25 in 1985. So I'm playing back to a period, I'm in my mid-40s and I'm having to pretend I'm 18. And it was like fingers on a blackboard, because you know, you want to play a woman of your own age and your own complexity. You don't want to be having to play teenagers. It became very uncomfortable. And that really was the sort of... See, now, if I'd had a heavier voice, and I could have moved into the more dramatic roles, but, you know, look at my body. I've got the long, thin neck. I'm not
well,
made to make
big sounds.
Well, the
truth is, you look much younger than you are.
Bless
your
heart. You know, occasionally people do cast you because you can play younger. But I'm still playing, you know, a woman of an age I'd like to play. I'm not having to play a teenager, which is nice. But there are no roles, and this is, you know, don't get me started on women aging in show business, in films, in television. Count the number of roles. Don't mention Helen Mirren and Judi Dench to me, because they are the only women who are
working. Right.
But even those people, I mean, I remember Mirren in his 40s going, well, it's all over, and, you know, I should... And it is very, very frustrating. I see the boys that I, you know, were playing my romantic leads in the musicals move on to Valjean, move mm-hmm. on to The Phantom, and I can't move on to anything because I don't sound or look...
Right.
We call it hags, bags, witches, and bitches, right? And I don't do them.
No.
I'm an older ingenue. To be honest, I haven't played a woman who hasn't had a title. Even this one's called La Diva. In the last 5 years, I've been a countess, I've been a baroness, I've been an empress, I've been all sorts of things. I don't do common, darling. It's the cheekbones. What can I tell you?
Well, all right. Talk to me about Living on Love.
The person that now works with Renee Fleming, who originated this role on Broadway that I'm about to play in Living on Love, he suggested to me after I did The Merry Widow that I start doing basically one-woman shows of just singing and talking and telling stories. And so that's what I did. And I got my foot back in the door doing musicals again and doing, you know, doing book shows. And I had always done book shows, obviously, because I'd done revivals of musicals. I've had to record half of Mi Cama No Mi Mi, and I burst into song during that. So when I open my mouth, you have to know that I'm an opera singer. So really, for a straight play, well, it's the gayest play for a straight play there's ever been, to be honest. It's almost like a musical without the songs. It's just I'm not actually getting to my complete comfort zone and just sitting there and singing a number completely at any point. I'm just having to do rather more book than, I mean, not even that. I mean, you know, My Fair Lady was a massive book, so it's not that much of a switch. Only if I let myself think, oh my God, you know, you're a straight actress, you're doing a straight play. But you know, the thing is, the careers that I've always admired have not been the people who have become superstars in one genre. So I would aspire, you know, whether I'll never get another straight play, I don't know. You know, there are an awful lot of straight actresses out there not working. Why would they take, you know, a woman like me with this very strange mixed resume? Because I had a massive concert tour of Canada planned. And that's mainly what I've been doing the last few years. I've now sung in every province and territory of Canada except Nunavut, the Yukon, and Quebec, because I can't translate my act into French. I have been everywhere. This time last year, I was on my way up to the Arctic Circle, where I fell off the snowmobile on the ice road. And this is the thing, and coming back to Les Mis, I've had these extraordinary experiences singing Bring Him Home, which I sing now in concert, and looking out into a fisherman's church on the Great Slave Lake, out, you know, in the Arctic, and a third of the audience are First Nations, Indigenous, in their gear with their mucklucks on, and they're all crying because they listened to Bring Him Home. So, you know, I've been terribly lucky, and I have kept going, and certainly the last 15 years have been very tough because there has been a lot of reinvention, but I didn't, just because the roles weren't there, I didn't want to stop singing because I could still sing. You know, and I didn't see why I should stop simply because the roles weren't out there for me. So.
Well, and now you have this role, so can you tell us a little bit about this role?
Yeah, well, she's hugely self-centered, narcissistic opera singer, and I've actually been living in character since I got the role about 6 weeks ago, and no one's noticed the difference.
I want you to talk more about the role, but I do want to say that I think one of the things that has helped you is your capacity to laugh at yourself if you need to. You know, I mean, that's a hugely endearing quality.
Yeah.
And also
it's
helps.
Very British, though.
Yes, that's
the
exactly
British
right.
Side of
that's
me.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, they call it taking the piss, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
And there's that self-depreciating thing. You take yourself down a notch before anybody else.
It does.
And they keep ticking me off for it in rehearsal.
Yes, 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 yeah, right. Okay, but it probably served you as well.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so tell us about your character in Living on Love.
Well, she's created this fake persona for herself, really, which is why I've kind of let my accent stay at the... I've made it slightly more American, and I'm laughing because actually listening to myself at the moment, I'm now sounding more North American. I float somewhere on a raft in the middle of the Atlantic, and depending where I'm living, it kind of wafts backwards and forwards. But because I am cranking up the American side of it, she's born in Boca, actually, but I've left my slight English accent going to give her pretensions. And she's married to this equally narcissistic, egotistical maestro, and they're actually madly in love with each other, hugely competitive. He's very macho, he's Italian, so there's the whole Latin thing going on, and they egg each other on. They have these two younger people who they both think they fall for. It's a farce, really. There's lots of running in and out of doors, and the costumes are amazing, and actually, if I get right down to it, I think I've probably only got into the business to dress up. And these are spectacular, absolutely spectacular, as everything, you know, the quality of everything in this company is extraordinary, I have to say. So I'm thrilled about wearing the frocks.
I'm sure you're delightful in it.
I hope so. I'm at the completely doubting myself, you know, catching the next plane back to Blighty at the moment. And I know it's part of the process, but everything gets harder as you get older. The doubt gets worse and worse, and the worrying about your memory, that's the terrifying thing. You know, you think, are you not remembering your words, or you're just frightened you're not remembering your words?
Right.
Oh, dear, but, you know, so.
Well, I know that Peter adores you, so I'm sure.
He's so kind. I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop. I keep thinking, well, he's so amazing. He keeps writing these things about comedy technique, and I just must write this down on the front of my book, because it's just little technique, and he lets you find your own way, but suddenly he goes up, and he gets up, and he just changes the timing, or changes a move, so the joke just drops like that. I've never worked with anybody quite like him, and I work with a lot of really good people. This job is just amazing. I'm so thrilled. I keep thinking, what did I do to deserve this? I really do. Plus, it's warm. The only thing is, I am away from home on Christmas, and until last night, when the young artists asked me to spend Christmas with them, I thought I was going to spend Christmas completely on my own, and I thought that, you know, I might accidentally drink too much gin and drown in the pool, or be struck by lightning on the beach, having a lonely walk or something, so that I know that's not going to happen now. And so that's cheered me up hugely. But to spend 3 months of the greyest and the darkest of the British winter in Florida is amazing. You know?
Well, it sounds like you've figured out a way to bond with the cast.
Well, we just laugh all the time.
Yes.
But that's why Peter's so great. If you've got a tyrant on comedy, yes, and you don't, but you're too frightened to be experimental.
That's right. Yeah, that's
if you
right.
can't be loose and silly, and I'm awfully hugely relieved also that everybody's talking so dirty. Because I've done a lot of opera over here, and they were quite uptight about that sort of stuff. I remember once doing a barber over here, and the director turning to me and saying, do you mind falling backward and him catching you by holding your breast? I went, God, no, you know, everybody else in the business has done it. And then he turned to the bass baritone and said, do you mind touching her breast? Well, that's how I reacted. And the bass baritone said, yes, I would prefer not to do that. And I thought, no one's ever refused before. And I had another tenor say to me, I don't do lip locks. You know, he wouldn't kiss. And I said, well, you need to find another, you go into oratorio. Because this is acting. You don't have to mean it. Just press your face against mine and wriggle your head around. It's acting. It's not personal. Trust me, it's not personal.
Okay, I ask one more question, and it is, having given a life to this work, and my dear, you have given a life to this work, really, could you say something about what it is like to have dedicated a life to this work in all the ways that you have?
If I had a child, and I don't have any children, I'd be very upset if he or she went into show business. Because it's a drug. That moment when it clicks on stage and you feel this incredible sense of something, that adrenaline, and I'm not bitter because I've really had a very lucky and wonderful career, and I work with wonderful people, and I've had some amazing experiences, but to be honest, I'm so sensitive. I don't roll with the punches. I find it now to go into auditions. When you're young and you go into audition, you're always hopeful and you don't bring everything with you. Now I'm like a turtle and my house comes with me. Everything comes in with me. And it took me years of going into auditions. I thought anybody who was in a position to give me a job must be superior to me, must have more knowledge than me, da 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 da. The penny only dropped about 6 years ago. A lot of the time, it's pearls before swine. Or you're not what they have in their head, but I'm not sure that the pain and the sadness doesn't outweigh the pleasure I've had from it.
Yes.
That's a terrible thing to say, but
yes,
I do think it's true. Well, but I wouldn't have done anything else, I think. I didn't really get a chance to find out. You know, I do have this huge love of history and old things and that. And I wonder if, but then what would I have done? I would have gone and been an academic, possibly, like the rest of everybody else in my family. But maybe that wouldn't have been as painful. I mean, I think, too, as a woman in the business, you get, you know, there I was at 40, just getting on top of everything I had and really having the knowledge. And the clock struck 12, you know, and I lost my slipper. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I know exactly.
I don't want
what
this to sound bitter because I'm not, but it's really tough. And I don't know. That's all I can say.
I think
it's a bit of a downer, isn't it?
Well, I think it's real. I wouldn't have wanted Pollyanna.
My honesty has got me into so much trouble in my life, and I think there's this thing, and you see it on things like Twitter and Facebook all the time, people projecting this perfect life. And I'm sure, you know, people are listening to this and they're thinking, you know, I would have been, you created the role of Cosette in a musical that will live on forever, and you will be ashes for thousands of years, and people will still be listening to you singing A Heart Full of Love. You will leave something tiny behind, and that is a wonderful thing, and I should be just happy with that, and I hope I will be at one point, but I don't think...
But you have to wake up every morning and live the day. I mean, really.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that's, you know, I mean, I think it's I think that you are pretty extraordinary, because, and I'm just going to repeat what I said earlier, they kind of threw you in the water. They didn't even give you, you know, a life jacket. And you just kept swimming. You just kept moving. It's extraordinary.
They did love me, though. They do love me. And they also believed in me. My parents thought I was very talented.
Yes, but
for various reasons, no, I didn't really get the equipment to go and tackle. And the interesting thing now is that I don't have any kids, but the thing I love about the current generation of young people is, unlike when I was young, I didn't feel that I could ask a woman, you know, if there was an age difference of 30 years, to be my mate, to be my friend. There was always that sort of thing. Now, if they like you, they do. So I have all these you know, kids in their early 20s who, you know, want to come out and hang out with the old people in the country, their country house, and play, and, you know, and join me for what I am, and give me the right, you know, things to say, and keep me down with the kids and all that kind of stuff. And I watch how so many of them are able to roll with the punches and are equipped to deal with the disappointment of it. And I just think, wow. And, you know, I wonder if I had been more solid and less wobbly and had not suffered so badly from depression and had more of a musical education and all the things that I needed, would I have gone on to do better in the business, go somewhere else? You know, woulda, shoulda, coulda. All I know is I'm still here, and I have managed 36 years on the lyric stage, and now I'm taking this jump into my first straight play, and with lovely people, thank God. And so, as I said at the beginning, I'm just terribly lucky.
Yes.
You know?
I think there was some luck in it, but really I think you're underestimating yourself.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. That's a good place to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Gosh, all the chocolate I shall eat now.
I can only imagine that, having listened to Rebecca both talk and sing, and we're going to go out on some more of her amazing voice. If you have not already gotten your tickets to Living on Love, you have run right out and purchased them. It's a lovely gift to give yourself. And I hope that when you listen to Rebecca, you are asking yourself, am I as tenacious in pursuing my life as Rebecca has been? Am I as clear about what it is that I do and who it is that I am? Do I feel about my life the way she feels about hers? That she's doing what she must do, that she's being who she is. That with all of the difficulty, obstacles, catastrophes, really, that she had to endure, she continued to write herself. That is, to be the person she actually is. And, at least for now, that person has landed in a place she really wants to be, doing what she really wants to do. So, if you can't say, yes, I am true to myself, yes, even when there are obstacles, I continue to pursue who I am, attempt to be the person I really am. If you were forced by conditions in your childhood to leave behind pieces of yourself, That is, of course, the work of therapy. And if you want to know more about that, how it might work, you can talk to me by going up to my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Click on the email tab, ask me any questions. At my website, you can also get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can listen to every show I've ever done, including this one. So, as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. We're going to go out on some more of Rebecca's glorious voice.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. On ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten